This is The Gardening Show
with Master Gardener Bob Harris
on WESB.
Presented by Worth W. Smith Hardware.
Call the show 368-WESB.
That's 368-9372.
And what a dreary, cold, wet day it is, Bob.
Yeah,
and indeed. I blame you. No, I don't. Welcome to The Gardening Show. The Master Gardener is in. Phone lines are open. We'll be on Facebook Live momentarily. Good morning, Bob.
Well, I have been wishing for some rain, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
If anybody out there has done any digging around, like I have, you'll find the soil has been very, very dry for this time of year. So this rain is real welcome. But today I want to talk about some of the odd things in the plant kingdom. And one of the most famous stories of all time is about the lemmings of Norway. Lemmings are a little a kind of a gerbil or guinea pig type of creature that lives off of grasses and sedges. And in Norway, there's an area where there's a lot of lemmings and a lot of grass and sedges. Two different plants, keep that in mind. And the lemmings feed off of those plants. And as they feed and their population starts to grow, and it grows very quickly, they have mowed the grass down to the point where they can't get anymore. So they keep heading towards the edge of the cliff. And eventually, some of them start falling off the edge of the cliff. And of course, that drops the population down. And so
they're not following each other.
No, they're not
blindly
following.
Like that's what the urban legend is. I know. Like,
yeah,
they're like lemmings. They all one jumps off a cliff, then they all follow.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. But that's not it.
They're just trying to get grass.
Yeah. And what has happened with the grass? Is as the population is low, the grass grows, the lemmings chew it down a little bit, it regrows as they travel along that edge of the cliff. But as their population grows and the plant doesn't have time to recover, it has to do something to protect itself. So all the grasses and sedges in that area where the lemmings are changes its chemical makeup within a 24-hour period. And what it does is in the digestive system of the lemming, it makes it so they even though they've eaten grass and they feel full or they are full, they don't feel full. So they keep eating and eating until they get right to the edge of the cliff and looking for more food, they drop off. Now, the grasses somehow sense this as that population drops down. And within a 24-hour period, the grasses and sedges get rid of that chemical and become edible again.
Wow.
And it was a mystery and studied and for over 100 years till finally scientists came up with all this.
So the grass is killing off the lemmings.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Indeed, that's exactly it, because the population just got too large.
For self-preservation.
Yep.
That's crazy.
But for some reason, you know, the grasses want the lemmings there, so they don't continue to make that chemical, you know, as that population drops down to a more manageable situation. And again, it's all in a 24-hour period. They stop making that chemical and become edible again, or digestible, so the lemmings can continue to survive.
That's neat.
Yeah, neat story. So I wanted to tell a few more stories about the oddities in the plant world, because in many of us, they're a whole lot like us. They may not have the exact same structure as us, but they do act a whole lot like us. So I'll talk about the sensitive plant. That's a Mimosa pudica, the botanical name. And it's a plant that originated, and this is kind of strange to me too, because it originated in South America. But the Egyptians, we found seeds from Mimosa pudica, or sensitive plant, in the Egyptians' pyramids. And we have learned that the pharaoh's children would have one of these plants, and he would show his friends that if he touched the plants, the leaves would fold up. That's what a sensitive plant is well known for. If you touch the leaves, they fold up. You touch it a little harder, the whole stem collapses. Now, this is a plant that originated in South America, so this really confuses me. How seeds were found in Egypt, and the story is that the pharaoh's children use this plant to show that they had a godlike touch, that they could make a plant fold up. Now, only they were allowed to have it. Nobody else was allowed to have it. But it's a kind of a peculiar thing. A lot of people have suggested that it's a defensive thing that the plant does, that grazing animals in South America come along and try to feed off the plant, and in order to protect itself, it folds and goes flat to the ground.
Now, do they come back, though, after
Yeah,
that?
They come back.
Because I would think that that would take a lot of energy to then.
Yeah, know. Indeed, it does take a lot of energy, electrical energy.
What?
Yeah. yeah.
You mean they're plugged in?
Yeah, kind of. All living creatures have an electrical impulse in them. And what really happens inside the plant is when it's touched, it senses that touch. And an electrical impulse is sent. So the potassium inside each cell is released from the cell, and the potassium holds water. And, of course, then the water is released from that cell. So the plant just collapses.
Wow.
Maybe as a sign of protection, we really don't know yet, and this has been studied for over 100 years too. We really don't know the whole process behind it. But other experiments have been done with not only can that plant collapse like that or move, it recovers after about 20 minutes, a half hour, and that potassium goes back into the cell, and the water goes back in, so we call it turgid. The plant is able to hold up its leaves and hold up its stems again. So we're trying to find out how it does it. And one of the most peculiar things about it is it seems to have a memory. If you continually do that, eventually the plant will stop collapsing from your touch. Some tests were done where they would drop sensitive plants in pots from so many feet above the ground down, and of course that jarred them and made them collapse. But after several drops, they stopped collapsing, as if they have a memory and telling them, well, this is no harm, no one's eating us, so there's no need to fold up. So that's one of the peculiar things about the sensitive plant, how it can move like that to protect it, maybe protect itself.
I wonder if it's because they could tell the difference between a touch and a hard surface or something.
Well, when you first drop it, it will do that.
Hmm.
It will fold up. But after several drops, it stops doing it. And same with your touch. The first couple touches do, it will fold its leaves up. But then after a while, it seems to remember
that
you're
a
touch and you're not harming me, so I'm not going to fold up, because it does take a lot of energy.
Wow.
So that's kind of peculiar, and a lot of studies are continuing on that sensitive plant.
And you said they're found in South America?
Yeah, that's where they originated.
But we're in Egypt.
Yeah. That's one of the really more confusing parts to me.
How did it get from point A to point B?
Yeah, exactly. Of course, now it grows all over Africa, but originally it was from South America.
Wow. Now I wonder if the wind might have carried it over, the seeds or something.
That's possible. Yeah. Wind, birds, anything like that could have, yeah. Mm. But scientists, botanists, agree that it originated in South America.
Neat.
Another one?
Oddities in the plant world.
Yeah. Another one that seems to move from touch is the Venus flytrap.
Yeah, we talked about that a few, maybe last month.
Yeah, maybe.
A neat plant.
Yeah, very neat plant. And again, it's all electrical impulse, just like in our body. Our nerves are sent by electrical impulses. Once you touch one hair of inside the Venus flytrap, nothing will happen. Once you touch two hairs, then the Venus flytrap senses that something is there and is not going to leave. So it closes up and it grows in an area where there's not a lot of nitrogen. It grows in the swamps of the Carolinas. There's not a lot of nitrogen, so it needs its nitrogen source from something else. So it's developed to get it out of insects and other creatures, too.
It developed a taste for meat.
Yeah, it did. And in South America, there's a lot of plants that have developed taste for meat. The bromeliads and pitcher plants. We even have pitcher plants around here that really survive on capturing insects rather than getting nitrogen, potassium, and so on from the ground. So that's another interesting one.
Now, just so I can sleep at night, there's no danger to humans that we know yet of any plant.
No.
There's no man-eating plant.
No. But they have been known, some of the larger ones, to eat birds.
Wow.
And lizards. Yeah. So they have developed into capturing larger prey than just insects.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, just very interesting.
Another oddity is plants seeing light. And again, they don't have eyes like we do, but they do have the capability of seeing. And a real famous one is the sunflowers. And now if you ever got a chance to go out to the Northwest and see some of the sunflower fields there, they're just monstrous. There are hundreds and hundreds, sometimes thousands of acres of sunflowers growing. That's one of their big products is sunflower oil.
Thousands of acres of sunflowers.
Yeah, as far as your eye can see, is just sunflowers. Big,
incredible.
Tall. And they're all facing the same direction.
Up.
No, towards the sun. Towards the sun. Okay.
I had to.
All towards the sun. And they follow the sun. Everybody knows that. But then at night.
So they lean at different angles throughout the day.
Throughout the day, yes.
Following the sun.
Yes, yeah. To capture as much sun as it can. The flower itself does. And that really confuses me because it's the leaves that are really supposed to capture the light, but the flower follows the light.
Hmm.
And then come nightfall, the flower will gradually turn back very slowly to be facing east. So when the sun rises, it doesn't waste 1 second of capturing that sunlight again.
Wow, it knows.
It knows, and the timing is just unbelievable how it can do that.
So cool.
Yeah, so that's another pretty interesting story about sun plants.
I will have to take a short break right
now. Oh, yeah, good.
And we can come back and talk more oddities in the plant world. Excellent. We'll be right back after these words from Worth W. Smith. It's The Gardening Show on B107.5.
You know it's coming. That cold weather is on its way. Make sure you're ready with a visit to Worth W. Smith Company Hardware in Bradford. It's not too early to start stocking up on wood pellets for your heating stove. If it's time to replace your pellet stove, see Worth Smith for their line of quality Harman stoves. You'll also find a big selection of stove pipes and other heating supplies in stock. And don't forget the antifreeze for your RV. Be prepared for the weather ahead. If you need it, you'll find it at Worth W. Smith Company Hardware in Bradford.
And welcome back to The Gardening Show on B107.5 FM. I'm Igor, and with me as always, the Master Gardener, Bob Harris. If you have a question for Bob, doesn't matter if we're talking about it or not, we are here for you. We're live, 814-368-WESB. That's 814-368-9372. And we're on Facebook Live as well. You can comment in the comments section your question for Bob there.
I want to get away from the oddities to just a neat story about plants. This came from a book I picked up in Portland, Oregon on a trip there one time, a huge bookstore. They say that there's over 1 million books in that store. But I tended towards this one about the cut flower business. And the cut flower business goes back 2,000 years. And today, about $50 billion worth of business in the cut flower business. And the Dutch are the biggest players, but South America and Africa are growing quite rapidly. And in the United States, we buy about 40 million stems a year from Holland. And there's an airport terminal in Florida for just flowers. And the planes are made to haul cut flowers, so they return empty, and around half come from South America. Besides roses, carnations, chrysanthemums, astromerias, and tulips, lilies are one of the most popular, and the stargazer is the king of all the lilies, the stargazer lily. And this is where my story will begin. I got to read my notes here.
Well, what's a stargazer lily? Is that because they prefer nighttime?
No. Oh, no.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No. It's just the name that was given to that lily by a man named Leslie Woodruff. He was a horticultural legend. Boy, hard
for me to say. Easy for you to say. Yeah, really.
And he owned a broken-down, weedy, insect-infested greenhouse and lily and begonia farm. But he was a very poor businessman, and he eventually went broke breeding his lilies. He just loved to breed lilies. And if you ever went to his farm, you would see dark-colored bottles with a camel hair brush stuck in the top everywhere around the farm. And it was a tool of his trade. He would tell someone, this little bottle doesn't have anything in it, nothing you can get high on or get happy from or fill your belly from, and you won't get addicted to it. But you will get addicted to its purpose. And he used it to collect pollen from one lily and with his little camel brush, and transfer it to another lily. He'd put the pollen on that dark-colored glass so he could see it, and hoping to breed a neat new lily, because he just was fascinated with lilies, even though he was a begonia farmer. And the pollen from different lilies, and then he'd once in a while he would collect a whole bunch of pollen in a bottle and then just shake it up and then just cast it into the air. Because his philosophy was like it was a deck of cards, that if you throw a whole deck of cards up into the air, eventually you're going to end up with a straight or a flush. And that was his theory. And he ended up with a great lily, the most famous lily maybe of all time. And
which is?
The Stargazer Lily.
Oh, yeah. That's the Stargazer. Okay. Yeah.
And so he went broke because he never patented the lily or any of his begonias. He just liked to breed them and sell them. And he really didn't take care of his operation very well.
Can you patent a flower?
Yeah, you sure can.
Wow.
Yep. And you can become extremely wealthy. You know, Leslie Woodruff would have been probably a billionaire by now.
Oh, my.
If he would have patented that. But along came the Dutch to save the day for Leslie and his family, because they went broke. They had to sell the farm.
But what year was this?
Oh, this was, I don't know, back in the 70s, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking it was like the 1800s or something.
Oh, no.
It was just recently.
This is recent, yeah. The Stargazer Lily hasn't been around a whole long time. What's neat about it is not only its beauty, but large flower, and it's one of those few that's been hybridized that kept its scent. So it's highly scented lily. And it grows right here in Bradford very well and multiplies. But the Dutch got a hold of the Stargazer Lily eventually. And, of course, they made millions and millions. And one Dutch grower heard about Leslie and talked to other growers in Holland. And they started a fund for the Woodruff family to make sure that they would have a monthly check paycheck the rest of their lives. What's odd is, you know, as businessmen, the Dutch are different type of business men than anybody else. They help each other because they are all in it to increase the business of cut flowers, not just to satisfy and make more money themselves. So they support other growers. Even a Dutch will support an American grower.
Well, that's enough. So Leslie didn't completely miss out then.
No, he didn't completely, no. But that's what really tickled me about the whole story is the man invented, I guess you can say,
yeah,
a flower that became extremely important and famous and was able to raise billions of dollars off of that. But the Dutch wanted to share that money with the man that first invented that flower.
You don't hear that very often in the business world.
No, you don't.
It's kind of nice, but yeah, wow. I guess when there's enough money to go around, when you we're talking billions of dollars.
Yes.
How much money does a company need, right?
Right.
So it's like, right. Okay, let's honor the guy that made this possible. That's nice.
But
even though it was like 0.005% of the
profit,
but
yeah,
still,
true.
But
true.
Still, you know, hey, yeah, pay it forward. That's nice.
That's right, exactly.
When you can.
Maybe they're the ones that started that pay it forward.
Hmm.
My hat's off to the Dutch.
We have about 2 minutes left in the show.
Okay. What do you want to talk about then?
Well, you still have notes.
Yeah, I still do, yeah. I don't know where to go next here.
Oh.
I'll start out a little bit now, but I'll continue on next week with this about grass. It's probably one of the most important plants and most numerous plants on earth.
Yeah, legal in New York now, but not so much in Pennsylvania. Oh, is that a different grass?
Yeah, lawn grass I'm talking about.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It covers a quarter of the earth, and it feeds more life than any other plant. It grows from the north of the tree line, the tundra, down to the tropics, and just within a few miles of the South Pole. And it's been known that it can be cut and grazed to the ground level and still recover, like the grasses with the Norway lemmings. And it supports 3 million caribou on the tundra and 2 million gazebos on the savanna. And
Gazelles,
yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, gazelles.
A gazebo gazebos. Is a structure that
yeah.
You can eat lunch under.
Thanks for correcting that, yeah. Gazelles, yeah. And at one time, probably 60 million bison in America. And in Tibet, the highest grass plateau on Earth, it supports the wild ass.
Mm-hmm.
And the pika and the rabbit, and which is a relative of the rabbit, the pika. And elephant grass is the tallest in the world, along with bamboo and corn. So grass is a extremely important plant. And like I said, grows all over the world and supports even me and you. You know that just about everything that we eat came from grass originally. And of course, now in America and most of the world, the most important grass product is probably the corn plant. Still, that's a neat story because it's quite a mystery of how it was developed. It did come from South America, most scientists agree, and now spread throughout the world thanks to guys like Christopher Columbus or others that may have been to America before him even.
Mm-hmm.
That's
really neat, though. I didn't realize corn is grass or a grass product.
Yeah, it's just a grass product.
Like a mutated grass, basically?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mutated, and probably by the hand of man.
Right.
They think it comes from a small grass in South America called tizanite that was eventually a farmer or an ancient person noticed mm-hmm. some had bigger seeds than others.
So they kept breeding.
And that probably,
yeah.
Most of the botanists and scientists agree that it probably came from their dump area. And they noticed in their dump area, certain ones had mutated and become better than the ones that were grown in the wild. So they, again, collected the seeds. And probably from the dump, a bigger one came and a bigger one came. And the history of the corn can go back to 10,000 years.
Wow. So, yeah, that's a lot of time to eventually get to where we are today to perfect it.
Yes.
And to, yeah, change the crop to your, to man's desire.
Really. Yes. And they know this, you know, from seeds they've collected in ancient sites and done the...
So they can see different stages of the progression.
Yep. And how it traveled north all the way up to Bradford, Pennsylvania, even eventually.
I'd love to hear more about this. So next week,
okay,
we're going to talk more about grass products and...
And the mystery of some of the plants.
Excellent. Yeah. And where they came from and all that kind of stuff. Great. So we'll see you again next week on The Gardening Show right here on B107.5 FM. Have a great weekend, Bob.
Thanks.
Keep dry.